Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about Russia's war against Ukraine, where things stand now, and what to watch for in the coming weeks and months. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Ruth Deyermond, senior lecturer in the Department of War Studies at King's College London, and a specialist on Russian foreign and security policy, U.S.-Russia relations, and European security. Thanks very much for joining me, Ruth.
Thank you for having me on again.
All right, it's great to have you on the show again. Now, it's mid-January, and the new year is already in full swing, but this is the first episode of this podcast in 2024, and I'm going to treat it as a New Year's edition in a way. I'd like to take stock of the current situation in the war in Ukraine and also take a look at the future, not so much trying to guess what might happen, but in terms of what to watch for as we enter this year. And I think a good way into this is to go back to a thread that you posted on X, formerly Twitter, on the last day of 2023, Ruth. You wrote that in recent months, there's been a lot of discussion in the West about a Russian victory, which is certainly true, but that, quote, Russia can't win, unquote. However, you wrote that at the same time, Ukraine could still lose and that the West could also lose. So that's my brief summary of your thread. Now, I'd be grateful if you could just sort of expand on those points, essentially explain what you mean and what it could mean for the course of the war.
Sure. So when I said that Russia can't win, what I was talking about was Russia's ability to win as measured against the objectives of the war that the Russian government and those around it set out 2 years ago, in the run-up to the war and in the early phases of the war. And there were several explicit objectives and some other kind of objectives that were clearly built in to Russian war aims. The first one, the one that actually got talked about the most in the run-up to the war, was the idea that it would allow a kind of resetting of the strategic map of Europe, that it would push NATO back somehow to the position that it had occupied before enlargement in the late 90s and early noughties, and kind of give Russia a kind of strategic, if not dominance, then a greater degree of strategic equality in Europe than it had had since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Then other objectives clearly stated by the Russian government were to denazify, as they put it, Ukraine, by which they obviously meant removing the democratically elected government and installing a pro-Russian puppet government, and stopping genocide in eastern Ukraine, which they claimed was happening at the time. And then finally, I think the other kind of key objective, which was built in to all of this really, was to reinforce Russia's status as a great power, to reinforce Russia's position inside the space of what we used to call the former Soviet Union, the post-Soviet space. And none of that has happened. In fact, the reverse has happened in every case. So rather than pushing NATO back, NATO has now expanded and looks set to expand further. And that expansion may, at some point in the future, include Ukraine. Ukraine is now closer to NATO membership than it's ever been before, and of course, keeping Ukraine militarily weak, not able to challenge Russia, was another part of the attempt to denazify, as Putin put it, Ukraine. So all of that is not only unachievable, but the reverse has happened. Clearly, the idea that a war in against Ukraine could result in the installation of a pro-Russian puppet government in Kyiv, that clearly hasn't happened, and it doesn't look remotely feasible now. And as for the genocide claims, well, I mean, these were clearly untrue at the time. But if there has been anything like genocide in eastern Ukraine, it's been produced by the actions of the Russian government, whose army have committed unspeakable atrocities against the civilians they said they were protecting. And then on top of that, of course, you have the fact that Russia has, with the exception, I would say, of Georgia, lost considerable ground in its relationship with most of the other states in the region, Belarus being the other exception, of course. So all of the original Russian aims are now unachievable. So Russia cannot win on those terms. But what Russia can do, what the Russian government can do, is win on other terms, right? And this is what you can see happening over the last year, really. I think a reframing of the objectives of the war. And it is clear, it's been clear from both Russian government statements and from the conduct of the war, that the objective now has been to wear down the Ukrainian armed forces, to wear down Ukrainian resistance through a war of attrition. But in order to do that, undermining Western support for Ukraine, since Ukrainian defense is so dependent on Western support. So if it is possible that the Russian government can manage to minimize or reduce Western financial and military support for Ukraine, then clearly Ukraine can lose. And it's entirely possible under those circumstances that Ukraine would get to a point where they would simply not be able to continue to defend their territory in the manner that they have been doing, and they would be pushed to some kind of, in fact, temporary peace agreement that would give Russia the kinds of things that it seems now to want. And of course, that I think in turn would mean a significant defeat for NATO and for the EU, for the West collectively, because it would demonstrate the kind of Western weakness that the Russian government has been talking about for at least a decade, 10 or 15 years, in fact. And because it would make NATO states much more vulnerable to various kinds of threat from Russia than they had previously been. It would make, for example, the Black Sea much more vulnerable, as a space in which NATO states and European Union states can operate economically and in terms of security. So I think there are all sorts of ways where we could see Ukraine losing, the West losing, but Russia still also losing. So it's a complicated picture, I think.
So is that thanks very much, particularly description. I think people forget about some of the Russian aims that it laid out before the full scale invasion of February 2022. Its demands essentially that would roll back the results of the essentially of the Cold War, the Soviet collapse, leaving Russia in control of more territory to the West, and also NATO kind of defanged, or maybe that's not the right word, but giving Russia much more influence and weakening NATO, kind of a reworking of the results of the Cold War, and as you say, the opposite seems to happen. I'm just wondering about not to sound alarmist, but you describe a situation in which if Western aid, I guess, and Western support fades substantially, that kind of all sides could lose, but Russia, but Ukraine would be forced into some kind of a compromise or, you know, a temporary agreement. And I mean, do you think that that's something that Russia really has now as its main aim? And if so, would that include kind of the current, you know, Russia controlling the territory that it currently controls, or pushing for more, for example, for control of all of the five regions that it claims are part of Russia?
It's hard to tell. I think that the Russian government is likely to push for the maximum that it thinks it could achieve, and that I think that would depend on how weak it perceived the Ukrainian position to be and how weak it perceived Western support to be. I definitely think that some kind of agreement like that, whatever the specifics of it, an agreement like that is something that the Russian government will be seeking in due course, because it's a kind of formula that has worked very well for Russia in this region in the past. So since the early 1990s, the Russian government has used so-called frozen conflicts as one of the key instruments of its coercive power over its neighbours, its post-Soviet neighbours. You know, sign an agreement, freeze the fighting, move or retain Russian troops into contested territory, and that then gives Russia a very large measure of control, not only over the territory that it occupies, but also the country affected, so the capital affected.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's been a successful tool of kind of Russian strategy in Moldova, in Georgia, and, you know, since 2014, also, of course, in Ukraine. And, of course, these kinds of agreements, one of the things that they do, and this was very evident in Ukraine since 2014, one of the things that they do is they allow Russia to militarily reinforce their position in contested territory. So any kind of peace agreement would allow Russia simply to consolidate its position, potentially with a view in the future to then launching another war, taking more territory. So I think, you know, for all those reasons, that kind of agreement would be something that the Russian government would seek. Whether it wants that right now is not clear, but it's certainly based on what the Russian government has done in other countries and Ukraine in the past, it's something that we would have to expect them to want in the future. And of course, that is only ever going to be a kind of temporary pause in the fighting. It's very hard to imagine a scenario in which any kind of peace agreement signed when the situation is anything like the situation it is now, it's very hard to imagine that holding, because neither side would have a long-term incentive to respect that agreement. And so, you know, the kind of calls that you hear in some quarters in the West for negotiations, I think fundamentally misunderstand what that would mean, and don't understand that that could only ever be a temporary pause in fighting, and a temporary pause in fighting that would really do nothing more than reinforce Russia's position.
Okay, thanks very much. And of course, the Ukrainian government, you know, argues quite often that, you know, this is a ceasefire is something that would, you know, that would benefit Russia, and you know, this can't happen. I think that's a good place to kind of segue to my second question, which also stems from your thread on New Year's Eve, and has to do with what Ukraine and the West can do. And so you wrote that quote, the capacity to determine the outcome of the war, a pivotal moment for European security and global stability, rests with the West, both the U.S. and Europe, unquote. And you also wrote that the West needs to decide what winning in Ukraine looks like. So you've discussed, you've talked about, you know, sort of what I guess a loss for all three sides, but a situation that would be a loss for Ukraine and the West could look like if Russia manages to, you know, to secure even a temporary deal with control over substantial portions of the country. But maybe you could walk us through your thinking on this, kind of maybe give an example of an outcome that would be a win for Ukraine, and explain how the West could do its best to help make that happen. And then, sorry, but a related or additional question, since I'm treating this as a New Year's podcast, is a win for Ukraine possible in 2024?
So, there's a lot to discuss there.
Yes.
I mean, in terms of the kind of the capacity of the West to determine the outcome of the war, I mean, that's my view because of the absolutely fundamental importance of Western material support for Ukraine. It's acknowledged by everyone, by analysts, by policymakers, by the military, on all sides, that Western support, military support for Ukraine is the critical factor preventing Russia capturing more territory, invading further Ukrainian territory. And the extent to which Ukraine can defend itself, and the ways in which it can defend itself, the ways in which it can push back against against Russian invasion, really is and has been since the start of the war, kind of shaped by the kind of military support that the West is willing to give and the quantity of military support that the West is willing and able to give. And so, you know, over the last year and a half in particular, you've had lots of discussion about, kind of long range weapons being supplied to Ukraine and whether they should be and what the implications would be. And it's been clear that there has been nervousness in some Western capitals, perhaps most notably in Washington, D.C., about providing Ukraine with weapons that would allow Ukraine to strike military targets inside Russia, so places in Russia from which the Russian army, Russian armed forces are launching attacks on Ukraine, attacks on civilian targets in Ukraine very often. And the capacity of Ukraine to respond to those attacks really depends on the willingness of the United States in particular, but also other NATO countries, to provide the kinds of weapons that would allow them to stop those attacks, to attack those targets. But as I say, there has been this reluctance to do that. There's been an anxiety that providing those kinds of weapons that would attack, you know, that would allow Ukraine to attack targets in Russia, mm-hmm. Would be seen as an escalation, that this could ultimately potentially draw NATO into the war itself, that it might lead to escalation to nuclear use by Russia, all the kinds of threatening noises that Russia has made around these issues, I think have dampened the willingness of the United States and other governments to provide the kinds of weapons that would allow Ukraine actually to adequately resist these kinds of attacks. If there was a willingness in the West to provide these kinds of weapons, the kind of support that the Ukrainian government says it needs, then I think that would have a significant effect on the outcome of the war, not just in material terms, but also politically, because it would send strong messages message to the Russian government that actually Western countries are not wavering in their support for Ukraine. On the contrary, they are actually kind of upping their support for Ukraine, because it's clear that this Ukrainian dependence on Western military support is one of the key vulnerabilities that the Russian government is targeting, and it's targeting it by attempting to undermine Western support, both, you know, by at a popular level, by kind of pushing out narratives using kind of different, excuse me, disinformation and misinformation techniques to try to undermine domestic support for aid to Ukraine in the United States and European countries, but also by, I think, you know, kind of engaging with political groups inside these countries. And, you know, I think the Russian government is also counting on key political figures in some of these countries, including the United States, in weakening support for Ukraine. So you can see everyone agrees that, you know, I think that Western aid, military aid, is the decisive factor in allowing Ukraine to defend itself. An increase in that aid could make a significant difference, I think. And so you can therefore see why it is that the Russian government is so concerned to undermine ongoing Western support. So that was the first part of the question. Apologies for taking so long. So what would winning look like? I mean, as I said in this thread that I wrote on New Year's Eve, it's one of the big questions that's been asked in lots of different environments, lots of different kind of places in the West for the last, certainly the last year and a half, I would say. There is a recognition on the part of lots of analysts, but also people in different governments inside NATO and the European Union, a recognition that there isn't a clear agreement on in the West on what winning in Ukraine looks like. Does it mean, for example, Russia being pushed back to the borders before 24th of February 2022, the start of this phase of the war? Or does it mean actually Ukraine takes control of all of its legal territory, so Ukraine gains control of all the territory inside its 1991 borders? Or does it mean something in between, so, you know, Ukraine recaptures eastern Ukraine but doesn't have control of Crimea? Crimea continues to be occupied. And those kind of three scenarios are the scenarios that you hear most frequently, I think. And there isn't a consensus amongst Western partners on which of those three scenarios, or indeed something else, would constitute a win in Ukraine. And I think, you know, it's pretty fundamental to any war that you are not going to be successful unless you know what your objectives are. And you can't support a partner waging a war, defending itself adequately, until you understand what you think victory is. So there needs to be a much franker conversation, I think, in the West, within Western countries and between Western countries, about what they understand winning to be. And I think one of the reasons why it hasn't happened is because there are, I suspect, fairly major differences between governments on this question. And so far we've seen NATO states, European Union states, attempting, with the exception of Hungary, of course, attempting to hold a kind of united position on Ukraine, more or less. Although clearly recent election in Slovakia hasn't helped that, for example. But broadly speaking, there's been a kind of consensus position. Once you start talking about whether or not Western states should be supporting Ukraine deoccupying Crimea, then you open up quite notable splits, I think. And so people have been trying to avoid that, but it's a conversation that has to happen, because, as I say, there is not going to be any kind of long-term resolution to this conflict until Western states know what the limits of their support are for Ukraine, and know what they want to see Ukraine achieve. And I think for that reason, actually, amongst others, seeing Ukraine actually win decisively this year, that looks difficult at this point, in all honesty, not least because there is this kind of uncertainty in Western support about how much support they want to give Ukraine, what kind of winning looks like. But also just because the nature of the war now, that because it is a war of attrition, these are not wars that are won quickly. So a decisive Ukrainian victory by the end of this year, I think, looks difficult. The key thing, I think, will be to provide continued, hopefully increased support for Ukraine, so that they can continue to push back against Russian invasion, and aim to achieve control of, in my view, all their territory, perhaps in the longer term.
Okay, thanks. And I guess I'll just one follow-up question on these issues. You kind of mentioned the importance of the West, figuring out what it sees as a win for Ukraine. But I guess I just whether or not that happened, and there are politicians in the U.S. and are certainly calling for, at least to some degree, are calling for the government to make that clearer. I just wonder where we're 2 weeks, it's 2 weeks into the year now. The U.S. aid is still kind of deeply in doubt. Congress, in Congress, after the holiday break. So I guess just wondering, how you see things sort of playing out. I'm not asking you to predict, but like at this point, does it seem like things will continue in terms of on the battlefield, more or less as they are, or if there's no new U.S. aid, for example, are things is there a risk that the situation could change pretty substantially in the coming months?
Yeah, I think that has to be the concern, right? I mean, it's hard to see how it wouldn't be. I mean, the scale of American support for Ukraine has been so great, that a kind of significant reduction of that is obviously going to have a major effect. And I think to kind of just expand out a tiny bit, if I may, I mean, I think one of the big problems in the Western debates around Ukraine and support for Ukraine, particularly in the United States, but also I think in Western Europe as well, there's a sense amongst some sections of the kind of political class that this isn't really a major problem, right? I mean, obviously it's a large war, and it's very regrettable, and they would like it to stop as soon as possible. But at some fundamental level, what's happening in Ukraine isn't a kind of really significant security issue for the United States. And that, I think, is a fundamental misjudgment. I think there needs to be a clearer communication on the part of the current American president, and leaders in other European countries. Needs to be a much clearer communication to populations, to citizens, but also to other members of the political elite, about why the war in Ukraine really matters, why it matters for American security, why it matters for Western European security. And that hasn't happened as well as it should have done, I think. And that's one thing that does need to change. And of course, it needs to change pretty quickly in the United States because we're at a crunch point, and then another big crunch point is going to come in November, of course, with the US presidential election.
All right. Well, thanks very much. That I mean, the stressing the importance of that, and you know, it does seem like a key thing that you know that you say needs to change. And as we go into this year, we'll see how that plays out. So I'm going to wrap it up here, but I really appreciate your comments, your analysis. Thanks very much for joining me, Ruth.
Thank you very much.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Ruth Deyermond, a senior lecturer in the Department of War Studies at King's College London and a specialist on Russian foreign and security policy, U.S.-Russia relations, and European security. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.referl.org.